Hi, listeners, and welcome back to Instamation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm Paul Townsend, your host through this experience. And today we're going to return again to the seedy world of financial crime. Now, the bulk of financial crime can be summed up in one word, fraud. Sometimes it's money laundering, where a person is fraudulently making it look like certain money was lawfully obtained when it wasn't. Sometimes it's Ponzi schemes, where investors are defrauded by being paid money by investment managers from newer investment funds rather than money actually made through those investments. And sometimes it's good old-fashioned cooking the books, misrepresenting earnings, profits, revenues, expenditures, liabilities, or anything else that's material and relevant to the financial health and well-being of a corporate entity. In this episode, we're going to focus on that last one. A large part of my firm's practice deals with white-collar crime. I've always found this particular area of criminal law to be especially fascinating because there are so many technical rules and regulations which govern virtually every aspect of the financial services industry. Now, there's no question that much of the country views Wall Street with skepticism and mistrust. The perception is that there's some sort of zero-sum game at work with the stock markets and trading in general, so that if Wall Street is making money, then someone somewhere else must necessarily be losing it. Now, that is, of course, not how markets work in practice, but I think it's a natural element of human nature to be suspicious of people in an industry who make lots and lots of money in ways that the vast majority of the population does not understand. Today, we're going to be looking at one of the single largest cases of corporate fraud in this country's history. We're going to give a brief explanation of what exactly the company and the actors did and the disaster that resulted. A number of people have reached out asking for a bit more analysis of the arguments and rulings, so we're going to try and do that this week. And to keep the timing right, we're going to get a little more condensed in the background. We'll still go through the important points so that we can all understand the case itself. In July 1985, a company called Houston Natural Gas merged with InterNorth, also a natural gas company, but based in Nebraska. The result was the formation of a company called Enron. Enron very quickly became a major energy, commodities, and services company. Prior to 2001, Fortune magazine had named Enron America's most innovative company for six consecutive years. Kenneth Lay was the CEO of the company from its formation. Enron used a big national consulting company called McKinsey. One rising star at McKinsey developed an idea to link natural gas to consumers in a more efficient and cost-effective way, turning gas into a commodity. It was wildly successful, and Enron hired the consultant and put him in charge of the division overseeing that process. By February 2001, the former consultant had worked his way to be the president and CEO of Enron. But then in August of that same year, he abruptly resigned with no warning whatsoever. By December, Enron had filed for bankruptcy. Several of the highest-ranking managers found themselves charged in federal court with conspiracy, fraud, insider trading, SEC violations, and other financial crimes. This is the United States versus Jeffrey Skilling. Jeffrey Skilling was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on November 25th, 1953, second of four children. His father, Thomas, was a sales manager at a valve company, and his mother, Betty, stayed at home. He spent most of his childhood in Aurora, Illinois, before attending Southern Methodist University in Dallas on a full scholarship. While in college, Skilling started out majoring in engineering, but switched to business. He worked in Houston for 2 years as a corporate planner before being accepted to Harvard Business School. All through his life, Skilling was a fairly arrogant person who took risks. He liked to bet on himself. And we see a prime example of this in Skilling's account of his interview for admission to Harvard Business School. According to Skilling, partway through the meeting, his interviewer tried to throw him for a loop by asking him whether or not he felt that he was smart. Now, if you have kids with you, or maybe you're driving in the car or something, fast forward for about 15 seconds, because Skilling's response does contain some profanity. Okay, so Skilling looks the interviewer in the face and responds, "Am I smart? Yeah, I'm fucking smart." Now, it takes a significant amount of self-confidence to make that statement to a Harvard graduate school admissions officer. But the truth is, Skilling was smart, and abundantly so. In 1979, he graduated in the top 5% of his class at Harvard, secured a very good job as a consultant at McKinsey & Company in the Energy and Chemical Consulting Group. McKinsey was, and continues to be, a hugely influential and prestigious consulting firm in the United States and regularly works with the best corporate entities in America. Skilling worked extremely hard and was very successful. He was one of the youngest people ever to be made a partner at McKinsey. While consulting, Skilling began to work with Enron, which had newly formed in 1985 and was looking to make waves in the energy industry. At the time, Enron was being led by Chairman and CEO Kenneth Lay. Lay took an interest in Skilling around 1987 when Skilling helped the company create a new forward market in natural gas. For those of you who aren't steeped in the finance industry, a forward market is an informal, over-the-counter financial market by which contracts for future delivery are entered into. These contracts are then traded on a futures exchange. With this innovation, which was not being done elsewhere in the natural gas industry at the time, Enron was able to make natural gas a commodity, which could then be traded on a futures exchange, and then cornered the market. This technique was wildly successful and earned Enron a massive market share in the natural gas industry. It became one of the largest companies in the United States. In 1990, Kenneth Lay hired Skilling to come work for Enron directly as chairman and CEO of the Enron Finance Corporation, which was a large division within Enron. In 1991, he also became chairman of Enron Gas Services Company, which was responsible for energy trading and marketing. In 1997, he was promoted to Chief Operating Officer of all of Enron Corporation, second only to Ken Lay himself. Enron prospered. Things were going well. Profits were up a steady 15 to 20% each year. The company was growing, and Skilling was credited for a lot of the success. In February 2001, Ken Lay stepped aside, and Jeffrey Skilling became the CEO of Enron. But then something very unexpected happened. On August 14th of 2001, a mere 6 months after becoming CEO of the company, Forbes magazine had rated the most innovative in America for six straight years, Skilling resigned, citing personal reasons. No warning whatsoever was given, and the news shook the energy industry. In mid-2000, Enron's stock price was nearly $91 per share. By November of 2001, it had dropped to less than $1. The SEC began an investigation into Enron, and on December 2, 2001, the company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. I can vividly remember hearing about Enron on the news frequently in late 2001. At the time, I really didn't understand the intricacies. All I knew was that Enron was a major company that had plummeted into failure at a fairly astounding rate. But what really happened? How did Enron crash so hard? Who was really to blame, and was it criminal? We could spend a lot of time going through what a special purpose vehicle is, or the accounting concepts of historical price indexing versus marking to market versus marking to model, but for the purposes of understanding the case, what you need to know is that Enron was using dubious accounting practices to keep losses off their corporate books, making the company look like it was performing way better than it was, and encouraging a lot of new investment when the truth was it was actually losing money on many of the risky ventures they had undertaken. If you can understand that, then you know more than enough to understand what happened next. In August 2000, Enron's stock hit its peak value of $90.56. But the executives, who possessed the accurate information that many of the risky gambles Enron was taking had resulted in major losses despite their public persona, were selling their stock in bulk, while at the same time promising investors that the price was going to hit $130 per share very soon. When news of the stock dump by the executives got out, the price of Enron stock began to drop, as others, assuming the executives knew something they didn't, also began offloading shares. Within a year, the stock had dropped in half to $42. By the end of October 2001, it was down to $15. But the executives kept selling. And by November 28, 2001, the price of Enron stock had dropped to below $1. Remember that Skilling, who had been chief operating officer and second in command at the company, was promoted to CEO, replacing Kenneth Lay in February 2001. So this was right in the middle of the stock's downward trend. He served in that role for less than 6 months, abruptly resigning in August of that same year with no forewarning, citing personal reasons. The surprise resignation of a CEO of a major company will have an immediate and negative impact on that company's stock price. And as Enron's stock was already trending downward, this news poured gasoline on the fire. Skilling then sold a massive amount of his Enron stock immediately after he resigned. I also just want to note that those of you with a vague recollection of what happened to Enron in 2001 will remember that their accounting company, Arthur Andersen, was almost always mentioned in the same sentence when talking about misconduct. We don't have time in this episode to discuss how their independent auditor enabled their scheme, and it's really not as important when we're discussing the prosecution of Jeffrey Skilling. But suffice it to say that Arthur Andersen, one of the largest accounting firms in the country at the time, also went under, had to lay off 85,000 employees as a result of their conduct in this case. Those of you who are interested can easily find plenty of information on how one of the nation's largest accounting firms failed to do their job and prevent this disaster by simply Googling it. Companies in the United States go bankrupt. It happens. Rarely does it result in a criminal indictment. In 2002, Skilling was brought before a congressional committee and grilled on the bankruptcy. Skilling denied any wrongdoing and asserted time and again that the board of Enron has always acted in good faith and performed their required fiduciary duties based on the information readily available at the time. He claimed that Enron had a liquidity problem and that investors simply got scared and sent the stock into a tailspin. He blamed the investors for failing to listen to the board's sound advice and stay the course while they dealt with the issues. He openly scoffed at any allegations of fraud. But Skilling and many, many other Enron execs were arrested and indicted. Most would end up pleading guilty and then testifying against Skilling. Skilling himself surrendered to the FBI on February 19, 2004, and was indicted on 35 charges, including conspiracy to commit securities and wire fraud, securities fraud, wire fraud, honest services fraud, insider trading, and making false statements to auditors. Skilling hired the law firm O'Melveny Myers, and a lawyer named Daniel Petrocelli was the lead defense attorney. Oddly, Petrocelli was not a criminal defense lawyer. He had made a name for himself representing Ron Goldman's father in the civil suit against O.J. Simpson. The judge in this case was the Honorable Simeon Lake. Judge Lake started his law career as a Judge Advocate General's Corps prosecutor, or JAG, in Vietnam. He was then in private practice with a civil law firm in Houston until he was appointed by Ronald Reagan to the federal bench in 1988. The lead prosecutor on the case was John Houston, a veteran of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Houston. Houston was aided by an army of prosecutors. Naturally, Petrocelli moved for a change of venue prior to the trial starting. Enron's bankruptcy in Houston had cost over 20,000 people their jobs, and Petrocelli argued, quite convincingly, that the media had so smeared Skilling there was no way a fair jury could be found in Houston. That request was denied. If you've listened to other episodes, you know how hard it is for a defendant to get a trial moved to another venue. It is incredibly rare. Looking back on this case with the benefit of hindsight, we all have this sense of assurance that Skilling and Lay defrauded investors and lied to the government about the financial well-being of Enron in order to inflate their bonuses and manipulate stock price. But in 2001, criminally prosecuting business executives for a failed company was a relatively novel concept. And Houston knew he had a pretty significant problem. He had no smoking gun. Between early 2002 and February 2004, investigators pored through more than 10 million documents trying to locate a single email, a single memo, a single shred of scrap paper, which showed that Skilling knew that Enron's accounting practices were misrepresenting the circumstances of the company. They couldn't find one. Normally, in major fraud cases, or really any organized crime case, prosecutors will try and identify the weakest member of the inner circle of the criminal enterprise and flip them into cooperating. In this case, prosecutors believed that weak link would be Chief Financial Officer Andrew Fasto. As CFO, Fasto had created his own personal investment company to buy toxic assets from Enron to get them off the company's financial reports. This wasn't illegal, but it was unethical. It was a crime, however, for him to secure promises from Enron that the assets would later be repurchased so that he was protected from any financial risk involved. Houston went after Fasto hard. He indicted Fasto on 78 counts of fraud in October 2002. He was counting on Fasto to come quickly and offer to cooperate in exchange for leniency. That didn't happen. Fasto dug in and decided to fight the case along with Skilling and Lay. Now the prosecution team was getting a bit nervous. They knew they had a case, but it lacked the element that a jury would latch onto to really grasp their argument. This was an extremely technical case. It was all about accounting, financial statements, and investor letters. A typical jury would not follow it with the interest that they would follow a murder or some other form of physical violence. What happened next is one of the reasons that many people look at prosecutors with skepticism. As I've noted before, the power to charge a person with a crime is a truly awesome power, and it carries a significant responsibility to act in an ethical manner. That does not always happen. Houston, knowing that Andrew Fasto was solely responsible for his actions, decided to go after Fasto's wife, Leah. The Fastos had two young children. Houston was counting on the idea that they would not want their kids in foster care with both the parents in prison. Leah Fasto had signed a single tax form indicating that two checks she received were gifts rather than investment income. The checks were disguised as Hanukkah gift checks, even though they represented investment returns from Fasto's company. Leah Fasto was indicted for criminal tax evasion. Now, normally, a situation like this would result in a civil suit by the IRS, repayment of the appropriate taxes, and possibly a minor fine, nothing more. But Houston wanted to squeeze Andrew Fasto as hard as he could. He offered Leah Fasto jail, unless Andrew cooperated. On January 14, 2004, Andrew Fasto pled guilty to wire and securities fraud, under a cooperation agreement with the United States Attorney's Office to testify against Jeffrey Skilling. Fasto then became the star witness for the prosecution. The trial began on January 30th, 2006. Unfortunately for Skilling, in late 2005, a documentary was released called Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. It was independently made. It had nothing to do with the criminal investigation, but it accused Skilling and others of orchestrating a giant Ponzi scheme, the largest in America to date. It lionized the whistleblowers and contained stories of multiple Enron employees who lost their pensions, their stock value, and their entire life savings tied up in the company. In his opening statement, Houston quoted directly from the opening scene of the documentary. He said, quote, "This is a simple case. It is not about accounting. It's about lies and choices." End quote. Houston made a wise decision to make the central focus of the case not on accounting, but on the persona of Skilling, who was not a very likable person. Naturally, this was an accounting case. The whole case revolved around numbers, figures, the dissemination of financial information. But if Houston had said that from the outset, he knew that he risked alienating the jury by boring them. Juries want to hear about the human aspect of cases, and that's what Houston promised to deliver. In the defense opening, Petrocelli decided to go straight for what he knew was going to be the heart of the prosecution's case, the cooperating witnesses. Petrocelli claimed that a failure of market confidence led to the financial crisis which caused Enron's downfall, and that an unscrupulous government prosecutor then put pressure on innocent business leaders to confess to crimes they did not commit and accept punishment and cooperate rather than face a public who had been instructed to hate them. As predicted, Andrew Fastow was the key government witness. Shockingly, none of the upper echelon of Enron management seemed to use email, so there was very little by way of communications among the top execs about what they were doing. But Houston's team did manage to find one document, which was the closest thing to a smoking gun that they could produce. It was termed the Global Galactic document because it was generated during a meeting which was labeled Global Galactic on the Outlook calendar of Chief Accounting Officer Richard Causey. The meeting took place September 6, 2000. The document was a three-page handwritten series of existing agreements between Enron and LJM, which was the management company Fastow had created, which led to his own indictment. The document outlined all the side deals which moved assets from Enron to LJM and how they would later be repurchased at no loss to Fastow. These transfers violated accounting rules and showed, Houston argued, how Enron was engaging in fraud by keeping these transactions secret to make the company look significantly more profitable than it was. Fastow's testimony asserted that Skilling was aware of all the accounting problems, that he knew about the transfers, that he acknowledged that they were necessary to keep Enron's books surpassing expectations and beating target revenue projections. The prosecution called several other strategic witnesses. Enron's head of investor relations, Mark Koenig, was called to explain Enron's business in a way that a layperson could understand. Many, many victims who lost their life savings were called in order to put a human face on the case. Pipe layers, utility workers, people who Houston believed the jury would identify and sympathize with, all detailed exactly how they went from financial security to hopelessness. It was a strong strategy. In the absence of communications or written documents which the government could point to in order to showcase what Skilling knew and when he knew it, they had to rely on getting the jury emotionally invested in a conviction. Houston gave considerable thought to the ordering of his witnesses, and it showed. Let's take a brief moment to discuss witness placement strategy. Not all witnesses are created equal. Some, like Fastow, deliver critical information designed to hit the jury hard with points which you need to make and be accepted without question. Other witnesses, like the pipe and utility workers, serve to frame the case a certain way rather than advancing a particular argument about the specific actions of the defendants. Those workers have no idea what Jeffrey Skilling knew or what he was doing. Knowing when to put certain witnesses on the stand comes with significant experience, and it can be a major factor in how witnesses are received, and as such, how the jury feels about your case when you close. Leading with a strong witness is important. If you put a less important witness up first, the jury will naturally think that you've done so because you simply don't have anything compelling to offer. And then when you do put a key witness up, they're already disinterested in what you're trying to tell them. Now, that certainly doesn't mean that you must lead with your most important witness and then order them down start to finish with most to least important. That's a terrible strategy. Witness ordering is designed to first grab the jury's attention, then keep them hooked, land major blows, and finish with something that will make a lasting impression. Good trial attorneys will spend a considerable amount of time and effort determining the order of their witnesses to maximize their effect on the jury. Houston was a master at witness ordering. He led with Koenig, the man who would explain Enron's business. The jury was given the impression that the prosecution was invested in giving them an understanding of these complex principles in a way that they could digest, because he had nothing to hide from them. The prosecutor wanted them to know and understand because he was telling them the truth. Fastow testified in the middle. This was done because Houston knew that while Fastow would deliver critical blows, he was also going to get dragged through the mud. The cross-examination of Fastow was going to be brutal. And so Houston did not want to have him testify last, where the cross would end his case. Houston needed the jury to remember the important things Fastow would testify to on direct, while maybe starting to forget some of the beating that he took on cross. Fastow was sandwiched between people who were used to put human faces on the case, which was also smart, because he was then associated with the victims, even though he confessed to being a part of the conspiracy. Houston's final witness was Enron's former treasurer, Ben Gleason. He was called last because he could corroborate the accounting abuses, but was not involved in any self-dealing. His image was that of a Boy Scout. He was professional. He was calm and balanced on direct and cross. Houston knew finishing with him would give Petrocelli a lot less to cross with, and it's a big win to have the final cross of the prosecution's case come off as bland. Gleason was able to testify that Skilling was aware of the Global Galactic Agreements without being subject to arguments that he would say anything to get out of being punished for engaging in those same agreements. The case went in just as Houston wanted. When it was the defense's time to put a case on, Skilling decided to testify. For 8 days, he was on the stand. He denied ever hearing about or seeing the Global Galactic document or any of the agreements that it contained. He talked about building Enron, first as a consultant, then as an employee. He bragged about his innovations and new ways of thinking that engineered prosperity. He again blamed a series of external factors for market downturns that sparked a loss of confidence and a stock price nosedive. He denied any knowledge of wrongdoing by board members or any misstatements to investors or the government. But Skilling's cross-examination was exacting. Sean Berkowitz handled the cross for the prosecution. He spent significant time on Skilling's incredibly short tenure as CEO, his abrupt departure, and his immediate dump of 500,000 shares right before the stock took another nosedive. Skilling had weak explanations for all of these. Berkowitz also hammered Skilling on personal investments he made into a company launched by Skilling's ex-girlfriend, which did the bulk of its business with Enron. By the end, Skilling had been confronted with enough evidence forcing him to make concession after concession that the impression the jury was left with was that Skilling was a man who would only ever admit wrongdoing when the direct evidence of it was shoved in his face. In their closing arguments, each side put forward the same concepts as they had in their opening. Houston chose to focus on the human aspects of the case rather than the numbers. He talked about the people who lost everything and the choices that Skilling made which cost them. He talked about knowledge, about intent, about greed and lies. He told the jury that Skilling orchestrated the single largest fraud on American investors in history, that he knew exactly what he was doing, and that when he knew it was all about to come crashing down, he dumped his stock so that he wouldn't feel the pain of what he'd caused on others. Petrocelli, on the other hand, argued that the evidence simply wasn't there. He focused on the lack of any communications or concrete documents which actually showed Skilling directed or was even aware of the problematic business and accounting practices. He claimed that the only evidence that Houston had been able to produce to try and link Skilling to this conspiracy was the testimony of people who had already pleaded guilty and would say anything to try and lower their own sentences. They knew what the government wanted to hear, and they were more than willing to say it to save themselves. Petrocelli also made an argument which, I think had he been more articulate with it, may have had the jury thinking a little bit more. The claim was that Fastow had pleaded guilty to wire and securities fraud. He was the CFO. It's far more likely that he would have kept his fraud hidden from his bosses rather than expose himself to them and possibly be fired and reported to the SEC. Petrocelli hinted at this and said it more or less indirectly, but he didn't put any emphasis on it. I think this should have been his main point. Fastow, as a direct report to Skilling, would have had every incentive to keep any fraud he was doing hidden from his bosses rather than openly discuss it. And if he was openly discussing it for a period of 2 years, he should have been able to produce at least one document which corroborated it. Instead, Fastow could only testify that the contents of the Global Galactic document were known and approved by Skilling, even though the paper itself doesn't indicate that at all. As we know, after 16 weeks of testimony and 22 total witnesses, the jury deliberated for a total of 7 days before convicting Skilling on 19 counts of honest services fraud, securities fraud, and wire fraud, but acquitting him of the insider trading charges. He was sentenced to 24 years in prison. This was later reduced to 14 years after the Supreme Court overturned his honest services fraud convictions, finding that Skilling's misconduct did not involve bribes or kickbacks. After serving just less than 12 years, he was released on August 30, 2018, to a halfway house in Texas, and then released totally from federal custody on February 21, 2019. In summation, I have a lot of thoughts about this case. First, I don't want to downplay the job that Petrocelli did here, but I think that Skilling would have done better for himself to hire an experienced criminal defense lawyer rather than a civil litigator. This was definitively not civil litigation, and a lawyer who knows the types of arguments that are going to resonate with a criminal jury would have been beneficial. I don't know that Petrocelli's lack of criminal experience is what led to beating around the bush on one of his most critical arguments during his closing, but I personally think that a more seasoned litigator would have recognized the importance of that point and really emphasized it. That being said, I think Houston deserves a lot of credit for running the courtroom. Most people who aren't litigation attorneys operate under the assumption that judges rule the courtroom. This is certainly the case in some situations, but very good trial lawyers will take that control and run the courtroom themselves. When that happens, it is the lawyer who shapes how the trial goes. Houston totally controlled the courtroom in this case. The evidence went in just how he wanted it, the testimony was expertly ordered, and nothing which he needed to put in front of the jury was precluded. He kept his narrative simple, tried the case perfectly. He could have easily put on 50 witnesses to talk about losses or accounting practices or any number of topics, but he kept it focused and he kept it narrow. Each witness added a specific element and fit into his story. This was great lawyering, and it paid off. While I'm certainly impressed by Houston's trial abilities, I emphatically condemn the strong-arm tactics used to flip Andrew Fastow. The awesome power of the government to charge people with crimes comes with real responsibility. That isn't just some trope from Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man. When doing justice is replaced by winning at any cost, there is a real problem with how government prosecutors are viewing their role in society. And we see the government doing this all too often. Remember the Michael Flynn case, where the government pressured Flynn into pleading guilty by threatening to indict his son if he didn't. It is imperative that prosecutors do not lose sight of the fact that, like it or not, they have a higher ethical standard that they must adhere to. Each time they don't, the sanctified wall of trust the general public has in the institution of the criminal justice system gets another crack in it. This case was by no means a sure win for the prosecution, despite how we all look back at it now. They had no smoking gun. Without Fastow, I think the government would likely have lost by virtue of having no real evidence that Skilling was engaged in the behaviors that they were accusing him of. Knowing that someone is doing something and proving it are two very different things. Jeffrey Skilling likely spent nearly 12 years in jail because Leah Fastow signed a tax form claiming that Hanukkah checks were gifts rather than investment income. That's the show for this week. A special thank you, as always, to Dan Townsend, a great brother who does my audio engineering and adds all the background. And thank you to all the listeners who have reached out by phone or email. I really can't tell you how much it means to me to have people tell me that they enjoy the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show on whatever platform you listen on and get automatically notified when a new episode gets published. If you want to reach me, you can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.